The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
They can't take it from me if they try. I lived through those early days. So many times I had to change the pain to laughter just to keep from getting crazy. Dressed in black from head to toe, two guitars across our backs, we would walk the city road, seeking someone who would listen to the music that we were writing down at home. But they can't take it from me if they try. Slick back with Vaseline, like the pictures on the wall of the local record shop. Hearing noises we were destined to remember, will the thrill to never stop. Come to you when you look for them, and your inspiration, long may it last, may it come to you time and time again. Seems to have their own opinion, who did this and who did that. But as for me, I don't see how they can remember when they weren't where it was at. And they can't take it from.
great to hear something from Jim McCartney Sr.
Isn't it,
on Wax?
Absolutely, yeah, amazing. His voice wasn't bad in his 70s.
Right, in view of, we don't have any real recordings of Jim Mack's band. Mm. It's nice to hear what he would have sounded like.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wait, that was Paul.
Wobbling all over the place.
Right. Yeah. Not to be cruel, but we pick that song from the new album for a particular reason.
Yeah, when we say the new album, we mean the album called New.
New, yes.
Yeah. Yes, we do, because very subtly, in a typical Paul fashion, he may be, we can't say we know for sure.
Yes.
But it sounds as if he's actually taking a pop at authors and journalists who, as George would say, weren't there.
Right.
You know, when, you know, with the Beatles experiences.
To do the stuff we do.
Right, exactly.
But on our own level, but, you know, there are people that would look at that song that are on a Mark Lewisohn level.
Yeah.
And think, oh, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Because it opens with the lines, "They can't take it from me if they try. I lived through those early days." If you want to put the emphasis differently to how he even sings it, it's, "I lived through those early days," right?
Yes.
You know, no one else did.
Emphasis added.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure what he's protesting here, because, I mean, I think we have it on record that he has claimed he doesn't read the bios written about him.
Yeah, but
certainly not tune in.
Yeah, well, they all say that. I don't believe it.
You don't believe it?
I don't believe it. Actually,
I don't know if
I'm not saying he'll read every single cheap bio on him, but he'll certainly, I think, read the likes of a tune in.
I don't know that he would. It's a lot of work, and you'd have to really be invested in it. I would just think revisiting your past like that, as curious as you might be, I could see him having an underling read it for him, or, you know, give him a summary of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look,
but slogging through it himself, I don't think so.
When I did the unauthorized biography of Sheryl Crow, but she herself authorized me to talk to everyone by her.
Is there a story there?
Well, the point is that everyone she basically knew through her life, all of her friends, all of her colleagues, were in there talking about her.
Mm.
It's the only book ever been written about her. And yet, the word came back in an interview. There was an interview in a magazine in which she said, the interviewer said, "Have you read this book?" "Oh, no, I haven't read it." And it was like, right. I mean, just crap. I mean, she's saying that to kind of distance herself from it and say, "I've had nothing to
do with
it."
And deflect being questioned about something
exactly,
that's in it.
Exactly.
But I think there's a big difference between somebody who, don't know how many volumes there are of Sharon Crow bios.
Well,
Sheryl
as I said,
bios.
It's the only one. It's the only one.
Well, exactly.
So, yeah.
And an entire industry devoted to digging up every detail.
But you'd think that the big major books, he would, as you said, at the very least, have a summary of the book.
That I could see.
Look up the index, see what's, you know, what's, because like the Goldman book, you know, you look up the Goldman book, the index on Lennon, and it's kind of, you know, murderous instincts of, and, you know,
right, every abomination known to mankind.
So
there's
at
an
the
entry
very
in
least,
index
he might do that, right, and have a look at the
perhaps
index.
I mean, I don't know at this point in his life if he's the least bit curious about what people are saying
right
about him.
Okay,
because I think he has spent a lifetime, largely post Beatles, trying to live down this perception of him as being a lightweight, especially, you know, straight out of the Beatle box, where you've got him, first of all, announcing the breakup and then ending the year by suing the other three, which puts him in a really bad critical light and on the defense for a good number of years, especially compared to the gravitas of the two albums issued by his former bandmates at the end of 1970, All Things Must Pass and Plastic Ono Band.
Yes.
When next heard from, you know, It's Another Day.
Yeah.
You know, as fine a pop record as that is, you know, you compare that to, you know, at the same time, George has got What Is Life in the charts, and John's got Power to the People.
Mm.
You know, you can quibble about how well those records have aged, at least in the case of Power to the People, but Another Day, I think, stands up. But what? I like the record Power to the People, but I'm just saying, you know, that kind of sloganeering is pretty dated.
Yeah.
It wasn't even his phrase to begin with.
I agree.
Right. Yeah. So I'm just saying is that Paul has been put in this unenviable position of constantly having to defend himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, I wish that, you know, when you've got the rock journalism press, you know, Rolling Stone sort of spearheading it, that have had their lead guy, Jan Wenner, their publisher, in Lennon's corner from day one, 1967. They put him on the front the cover of the first Rolling Stone, and then supporting him uncritically thereafter. You know, Paul is made to look like the odd man out, the outsider, the uncool one, the lightweight, you know, Mr. Thumbs Aloft, and, you know, putting his untalented wife in a band and all this other stuff.
Oh, the true stuff, yeah.
It is all true, but it is unfair, the judgments of him, because they weren't willing to recognize when he did do something decent and not recognize him for the artistry that he did possess, which might have been considered unhip at the time.
Yeah, but I mean...
But that kind of, you know, public taste like that come and go.
No, I agree. I mean, let's face it, you know, and he said so himself. It's kind of obvious, right, that John died and through no fault of John's, you know, basically he gets martyred as such and then Paul's like, you know, the one with the thin end.
Right, the survivor who's left in the dust.
Right.
And while John spun a lot of myth about himself in his own lifetime, the deification that came in the wake of his death is something he might have had a problem with.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, in terms of what he spun, I mean, McCartney's certainly spun enough about himself as well.
I don't think it's on the same level, though.
That we'll disagree. That may be another show, but
yeah.
I disagree about that.
He's not mythologizing himself the way Lennon did.
Right, but he also hasn't copped to what Lennon copped to, right? You know, Lennon did admit stuff about himself
true. If you're talking about bad behavior, well, that's every one of them.
Yeah, but McCartney hasn't admitted to the kind of levels of bad behavior that he's been guilty of, but which Lennon admitted to in his own case.
Okay, I know you like this equivalence between them, like, you know, well, John at least admitted that he beat women, and Paul never did. Mm. At least John is on record. We've got women who came forward and said, yeah, he did.
Mm.
And I don't think you can say the same thing about Paul. I think we have suspicions.
Heather came out in a court.
She intimated that and said things, yes. But you know what?
She said it.
Are you looking at her as a paragon of truthfulness?
No, but it does echo what others have said. That's why I'm saying
I'm saying considering the source.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if Linda had ever penned an autobiography and it was in there, then I might take it a little more seriously.
Well, she wouldn't do that. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Therefore, but it's an odd story.
The fact is, this show is actually about McCartney today, but it also does hark back because here we are talking about journalistic coverage of McCartney.
Yes.
And
the sort of defensive posture even now that he could write a song like that, like I was there and you weren't.
Mm.
You know, I would think somebody who recognizes their role in history, especially as they're entering their twilight years and wants to leave a legacy behind, which clearly he's been desperately trying to pull himself out of the shadow of John Lennon to make sure he gets recognized in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a human being. Fair enough. You know, you don't want to be minimized and marginalized for his rightful role in the Beatles' greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And he's facing this tidal wave, you know, pushed by Yoko and pushed by the martyrdom of John, it's a very hard thing to fight.
Well, we've got on the show today one of the chief architects the kind of anti-Paul propaganda.
Yes.
The author of Shout, Philip Norman. That came out, I think, in 81.
Yes.
And I remember...
Just months after Lennon's death.
And I've got to tell you, because I was, you know, joke if you want, but I was obviously feeling pretty emotional about John's death at that time, as a lot of us were. And it actually turned me more against Paul, that book. When I read that book, it was like, I literally hated him after that, you know, for a short time.
And
it did a short time.
A mere 40 years.
No, but in all seriousness, no. I mean, in all seriousness, I don't hate him. You know, I love him. He's a Beatle, right? I'm not an admirer of much of his solo work. Yeah, I'm not an admirer of much of his solo work, but you know that. But what I'm saying is that at the time, God, never going
to. Spit it out.
Just never going to just deal with this straight. The fact of it is that at that time, it did make me feel really kind of bitter to Paul. It was almost like how he mistreated John. That's how it felt.
Were you, what, like 25 at the time or something?
I was 22.
Okay. You know, when you're sort of in that young adult sort of mindset,
yes,
it was a very easy thing to embrace. Because I know I was a teenager when I read Lennon Remembers, and I bought every word of it, uncritically.
Me too.
You know, because that's your sort of mindset. You know, you're sort of
react.
Iconoclastic and, you know, anti-establishment.
And you react to everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's very vivid. And of course, you know, a Playboy interview comes out.
Yes.
And again, you know, he's doing what he does, which is just, you know, smash every icon in sight and you know, promote himself as the truth teller. And I see things clearly, and this is what the reality was. And you want to embrace that. I think for some people, as you mature and start to revisit things and look a little bit more clear, you can recognize, well, that's hyperbole. Well, and
we're also better informed now than we were.
We absolutely were. But I also think you can read sort of the nuance. And, you know, as we've talked about on the show, when the tapes actually surfaced of these interviews, you know, what comes across one way in print is very different.
Oh, absolutely.
When you hear
the
way it's presented.
Yeah. Because when I first read, as you say, Lennon Remembers interview from 1970 in book form, you know, it just, to me, it sounded like by about getting a third of the way through it, I just heard Lennon almost hysterical all the way through and really, really angry.
Right.
When I finally heard the tapes of it, you know, it was a whole different story.
Yeah, it's a lot more measured, even if the actual words he's saying are kind of...
And that actually was a big lesson to me as a writer.
Yes.
That, you know, you have to be careful. If I do an interview with someone and want to faithfully reproduce word for word how they said it, it sometimes will convey the wrong message.
Right, the actual words somebody says might not be what they meant.
And so they always get to actually see, I always submit to them before I have something published, which is kind of unusual, but I do that, so they read it. And I do make alterations to make sure that it conveys what they mean. Not major ones, but because that is the problem.
Right, not doing a 180 on it, but you know, some the actual black and white words in print might not capture what you're really meaning to say.
They don't capture the tone of voice.
They don't at all. And you might express it differently once you see what those words look like.
Right. So, you know, in the case of the Philip Norman, as you say, these days, even if I wasn't as well informed, I'd most likely be able to see through the writing because he has very sort of fancy prose at times. He gets quite flowery. And whilst it can make for some memorable passages that sort of resonate, you know, I would, as a writer now, basically see through what he's doing a lot of the time. The one thing I did see through at the time, I found it really difficult to buy into, was the major selling angle of that book was that Brian Epstein had been murdered.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, was that Brian had been murdered. And I did, even at that time, at 22, sort of think, oh, that's just an angle to sell this book.
Well, it you go for the salacious when you're trying to get that little sound bite that's going to help market the book.
Mm.
You know, it's something that Pauline Sutcliffe learned, you know, in her second go-round when suddenly John Lennon murdered her brother.
Yes.
Which was something that had not been the case the first time.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, okay, what could we hook this on?
Yeah. And you that's what people should know, that publishers always, a primary question when you pitch them a topic, or most topics, unless they're so red hot that it doesn't really matter, they usually want an anniversary or some hook to hang this book on to try and sell it.
Right, it's just a marketing lever.
Yeah. Right. And as the author, it's down to your own integrity as to how far you're willing to go with that. Are you willing to actually delve into fiction to do that, or are you going to just stick to the truth? I don't feel that Philip Norman stuck with the truth.
No. And, you know, everything you need to know is summed up in the line he said on television when promoting Shout, when he said John Lennon was 3/4 of the Beatles.
Yeah, a ridiculous thing to say. I mean,
and he said it with a straight face. He wasn't being ironic or cute.
Believe me, in my biggest Leninista mode, I would never, ever say anything. I mean, that's just a ludicrous thing to
say. And maybe we should get a little background. I mean, Philip Norman was a professional journalist.
Yes.
He, in fact, as he talks about in the onset of the new book, he interviewed the four Beatles, or at least he met with them backstage in 1965 as a young journalist.
Yes.
So it wasn't like he was this, you know, a fan deciding he's going to write a Beatle book. He was a guy who had a certain professional background.
He was roughly, I think, about Paul's age.
I think a little older than the Beatles, but which surprised me because at the time I really didn't know.
Right.
But so he's a contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would have been seeing a lot of the world through their eyes.
Mm.
And as he... I asked him directly when we talked to him about, you know, is this book meant as sort of a mea culpa for your years of horrendous slagging off of Paul McCartney? And he said, you'll hear it in the interview, but, you know, he tried to do a little bit of corrective with the Lennon bio. But the fact that he went so out of his way to go after Paul gratuitously through the years.
Through the years, that's the thing, because, you know, Shout is 81 is when it's published. Yeah. But... you know, right through the 2000s, he's been like in the Daily Mail in the UK and various publications, you know, really slagging off Paul. And we're not talking just some constructive criticism. We're talking...
we're not talking about bad review.
No, we're talking bitchery, basically.
Well, okay, there's the thing from 77 when Mull of Kintyre comes out.
Go on.
And he writes that prose that got published.
So this is before Shout. Okay.
Yes, it's before Shout.
Yeah.
Oh, deified scouse with unmusical spouse, for the cliches and claw you unload... to an anodyne tune, may they bury you soon. in the middlemost midst of the road.
Yeah.
So in two couplets there, he manages to slag off Paul's wife.
Yes.
Slag off his musicality and call for his demise.
Right. Yeah, I know. That's the thing. It's gratuitous. It's really way over the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, makes Jan Wenner look like a Boy Scout.
Yeah, well, you know, as recently as September of 2003 in the Daily Mail, it was in the wake of McCartney getting bad press as a result of swearing within, you know, public hearing against David Blaine, who's an illusionist,
yeah,
and was doing a big sort of stunt in the UK.
That was the thing that got Baker fired, right?
That's Jeff Baker. Well, it kind of was preceding that, actually, but... yeah, you know, Paul was called Blaine the C word audibly for no reason, just unprovoked.
Well,
the guy was like in this plexiglass cage.
Yeah,
and
that
he was trying to free himself from it.
But Jeff Baker had tipped off the press,
yeah,
that Paul was going to be there,
yes,
checking out this thing in public.
Yeah.
And I guess he was in no mood to be accosted or approached.
I think also he was very possibly stoned.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Shocking.
Yeah. Anyway, Philip Norman then wrote this article in the Daily Mail, scripted as if it was an open letter to Paul, but it starts, "Dear Macca," as if he would really write to him that
concern
way.
Concern trolling.
Yeah. You know, and just, you know, amongst the things that he says there, he said, "You were a secular Saint Paul, and the world and the world's media ate out of your hand. Well, what a difference 35 years and £1 billion make. In those days, it was hard to find a McCartney headline that didn't sing your praises even more lyrically than you sang them yourself. Today, it's hard to find one that doesn't portray you as egotistical, grasping, small-minded, self-deluding, more than slightly absurd, and now, to cap it all, as moody, rude, and foul-mouthed as any delinquent from Pop's kindergarten." So he's not exactly pulling his punches there.
No, he's clutching his pearls.
Well, yeah, because he then goes on to say a bit later on in this letter, "Your hair dye is so obvious that when you last played at the Oscars, it received an unofficial award as the evening's best special effect."
Jeez.
Meow.
Yeah, a bit.
I mean, really? You know,
this is from the same guy.
Is that solid journalism?
This is 2003, right?
Yes.
Yeah, this is 2 years after, or less than 2 years after, days after George's death.
Mm.
Did you read the thing he posted, the so-called obituary for George Harrison?
No, I didn't.
It would do Dave Dexter proud.
Oh,
if you
really
remember the thing he wrote in Billboard after John was killed?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, really?
Well, tell listeners, you know, what Dave Dexter said.
Oh, well, Dave Dexter, when he posted what was meant as like this black bordered tribute in Billboard magazine, it basically was taking John to task for being the most difficult of the Beatles and ungrateful, and how dare he not appreciate everything Capitol and he himself, Dave Dexter, did for you.
That's right.
Yeah.
All that lovely reverb they smothered all over you.
Yeah. What a pain in the ass he was.
Yeah.
Too
nice.
Bad he's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really.
So, people were mortified, and I know that I'm trying to remember who it was. People pulled their ads from Billboard in protest after that.
So what did Philip Norman say about George after he died?
Well, basically, I'm not going to read the whole article. People can Google Philip Norman and George Harrison, but this was posted days after. I think it was like December 2nd, 2001. And it's a Goldman-worthy essay on George. Too bad he's gone. But, and it goes on to cite every negative thing, real or imagined, you possibly could. You know, the salacious details of his womanizing, of, you know, Maureen Starkey thing, of too bad he just struggled mightily in the shadow of the genius that was Lennon McCartney. You know, talks about this is his guitar playing. You know, so it's sort of precursing Jeff Emmerich there.
Mm.
And, you know, the only great song he did was Here Comes the Sun, which must be the one that he liked.
There you go.
And just goes on and on. That, you know, basically sums up saying, I guess in the end, it's too bad that being a Beatle wasn't enough for him.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
It has to be read to be believed, though. This is, you know, people are mourning. This is days after George has died. And this is what he digs up to say about him.
Presumably, Philip Norman would say that all he was doing was telling the truth. And, of course, I can be accused of the same thing, you know, some of my views and you on this show, right?
Well, it's a sort of counterpunch because he goes in there to mention, like, the over-the-top hyperbole from people who are praising him to the skies.
Right.
He mentions Jim Capaldi comparing him to Jesus for the first line of While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yeah.
But come on, these were people that knew him. I think you're allowed a little bit of hyperbole when somebody you loved had died.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, why can't we put the emphasis when they died on the good that they've done.
Yeah.
I'll give you, you know, a prediction right now. That's what I'll be doing about Paul when he goes, you know, because seriously, I mean, what he contributed, not the negatives, it's the positives. And Philip Norman knows full well, as any author or journalist knows, that the bad sticks far easier than the good.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, when these people say things like, I saw Kitty Kelly, you know, another sort of trash journalist that, well, you know, I report the good and the bad. Well, that's great, but you know that even if it's 50-50 good and bad, it's right. the 50% bad that's going to stick.
Right, and I think headlines. About the Peter Brown book.
Right,
Love exactly. You Make. Yeah. It was just one big gossip fest
yes.
that clearly he was tired of being a Beatle insider.
Yeah.
And he wanted to make sure he was persona non grata from right. that point on, and that's exactly what he did
And
himself.
The answer as an author is, or as a journalist, that when you are writing a piece about someone and you don't want the bad to actually come over too strongly, you do have to weigh it in a way that you really emphasize the good. You talk about the bad, but you really punch home the good to try and get it to just balance out, because otherwise it's the bad that just will get the headlines.
And that had been his MO, Philip Norman's, for, you know, the duration of his career, through the Beatle years, through the 70s, 80s, 90s, whenever there was an occasion to talk about Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, when the book came out in 2008, but I have to think he started researching it a few years before, the John mm-hmm. Lennon bio,
mm-hmm.
you know, he decides he necessarily has to talk to Paul to do a complete portrait of Lennon.
Yes.
So now he's prepared to make nice.
Yes.
And I should point out that when he was working on this book, and he and Paul gave him some, which he didn't need to do, some begrudging cooperation with it, which Norman would then say was very helpful, and that he, in effect, tried to redress some of his past grievances by being a little more positive and balanced toward Paul
right.
in the Lennon book.
Yeah.
But it was in the course of this that the quote came up where Yoko says to him that no one ever hurt me like Paul did, right. quoting John.
Yes.
And this was a quote that made its way back to Paul when he read about it in the press. And so he actually contacted Norman's office
yeah.
and tried to get him to elaborate,
yeah.
not to be accusatory or to beat him up or anything. He's like, you know, tell me more.
Yes.
And Norman didn't return the call.
Right.
Yeah. And then so when we got a chance to ask him about that, I think his answer is very interesting.
You talk in the new book about how Paul had reached out to you when he heard from Yoko, quoting John, no one had ever hurt him like Paul did. Did you ever have that follow-up discussion with Paul or even with Yoko about exactly what was meant by that?
I didn't. You see, at the time, that was after the publication of Shout, I didn't think I would be doing any more work, any more writing connected with the Beatles. I thought, that's a biography, and I'll do another biography of another subject.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize you don't get away from the Beatles. So when Paul phoned my flat in London, I wasn't in, and my girlfriend took the call and said he was very upset about that remark of Yoko's, but I didn't follow it up. Now, that seems madness now, but I just didn't. I thought, this is not relevant, whatever John meant. Doesn't matter to me because I'm not going to write any more about the Beatles. But I was totally wrong, of course.
Is it something that occurred to you that maybe this would be something at least maybe should be put to rest with Paul?
I don't think so. And I don't think anybody would remember now. Certainly Yoko wouldn't remember the exact circumstances. The way that it was expressed struck me as sort of singular. It sounded like a sort of a thing a spurned lover would say.
Yeah.
There was no physical love affair between John and Paul, but there was certainly an incredibly strong love.
Yeah.
And on John's part, perhaps more than Paul's.
I bet when he said that Paul was upset when he spoke to his girlfriend, he wasn't just blubbering at the end of the phone. He was most likely absolutely ready to kill.
Probably. We'll never know. So you and I are sitting here right now trying to do a sort of evaluation of Philip Norman's journalistic approach to Paul McCartney and the Beatles. And I'm not a journalist. You know, I see my strength as I'm a writer and a researcher. You know, you're the journalist. But even I am stunned by his complete lack of curiosity there.
Well, what is this kind of, it was so long ago, it doesn't really matter or no one remembers.
Yeah.
Is that journalistic integrity? I mean, what the hell is that?
I can you imagine hearing that from Mark Lewison?
No, I can't.
There's a difference.
To answer that, no, I can't.
It's stunning to me because, my God, if you've got access like that, you've got the opportunity to go down that hole and get an answer.
Yes.
You know, and I'm not here to beat up Philip Norman. You know, I
well, you're certainly not here to praise him.
I'm trying to be balanced because nobody's either black or white.
But you
and
know what?
He did a good job of being black and white on Paul McCartney for a good many years.
Yeah.
And I think he tried to redress it in this book, this 800-page life story that he did that I suppose he intended as a definitive work of Paul.
Yeah.
It ain't that.
Yeah. Well, it's full of errors, isn't it?
It's full of errors. I mean, every book is.
It's not bad. I mean, that's bad.
Errors
right
that didn't
there.
Need to be made.
Right. So that makes it bad.
It makes it, you know, I mean, you and I know things about the publishing business. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they had a date they had to reach. I'm sure that it was probably up until the last minute still being worked on.
Yeah, but come
but
on.
There was no layers of just have one or two Beatle fans read the goddamn manuscript.
Yeah, but Robert, come on. You know, also with the publishing business, there are books that are, you know, turned out in a matter of weeks to capitalize on.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah, and this was not that.
And this is not one of them, and this is one where he's being paid a big fat advance, okay?
Presumably.
And so basically you expect a top work. He's doing this as a major
yeah,
biography.
But I also know how publishers work, and if they make mistakes, they don't care. They want to sell as many copies as possible before the public figures
yeah, but,
out, oh, this is not as good a book as
but,
it's
but an
touted.
Author of his standing can absolutely have control on that.
I would think so, yes. Oh, I'm not defending him. I'm just saying is that I could see how this would have been ramrodded through, and that they wouldn't have cared at this point. But they're just out there to, you know, get the press junket out there, get the press, get the reviews, get all that stuff going, sell as many copies as they can before it gets remaindered, and that's that.
But what we've already heard from him kind of gives you an indicator he basically doesn't really care.
Well,
he's
going to
get away
with
what he can.
That.
And we're going to have more of that coming up
yes.
in this interview.
Yes.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, the thing before with that open letter in the Daily Mail, where he goes on about the hair dye, that really is so transparent about to show me what he's really about.
Yeah.
He's really just trying to get gratuitous digs in, and it shows him up there.
As I he mean, did in the George piece.
Yeah, as they say in England, he's showing his ass, basically. I mean, it's really not good. He's showing his hand.
I read the article, both articles, but I hadn't read the comments, and I'm kind of curious of what kind of pushback there might have been from the public in both instances.
Right.
I mean, were the people like nodding, go, yeah, you nailed him, Philip, or they're like, you know, what kind of garbage is this masquerading as journalism?
Yeah.
You know, this catty... Yeah. Gossip crap.
I mean, you know, I know listeners may think I'm guilty of the same thing. I will absolutely disagree with that. No, not at all. No, I would completely disagree. You know, this is just, I say, cheap shots the whole time. Yes, I do. I joke with stuff, right? You know, I'll jump in on stuff. Yeah. I'll definitely cop to that. But in terms of, you know, stating what I really think, I would never do this. And in a major biography and the way he's promoting it, and this complete about face, that he's gone from McCartney attacker through and through to now McCartney defender is ludicrous.
You know, I'm willing to give people the benefit of the doubt if they're willing to revisit their previously held convictions on things and see it through new eyes. And I think, to a certain extent, that might be what he's trying to do. And I will tell you, having read the damn thing, I thought there were parts of it that were worth reading in terms of research. The earlier parts of Paul's life, because I guess he got a lot out of Jim McCartney's widow and stepdaughter.
Angie.
Now, Angie and Ruth. And to the extent that these are people who don't have a vested interest, of course they do. They're going to spin things the way everybody would decades later. You know, they got their own little cottage industries going on that they want to promote and keep their name out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of you have to decide, well, what are you willing to believe? Mm. I mean, he portrays in the book a wonderfully warm portrait of Jim McCartney Sr., which I think is a great thing. It's pretty more fleshed out than a lot of what I've read. Okay. And a lot about Paul's childhood, and it's very vivid. Mm. Now, you know, there are things in there that I haven't fact checked, so I can't say, you know, this is exactly spot on or
that's what's scary.
Glaring errors there are,
but that's
considering the ones I have caught.
Is even exactly when you even just scan it or look at photo captions and you catch errors, you know, there's a problem.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So
I remember, for instance, with the Lennon biography by Goldman, and he had a picture of the Beatles meeting the Maharishi, I think in London or Bangor, I'm not sure which one. And, you know, in the captions, it says unidentified woman. And that was Patty Boyd.
Right.
As soon as I see that, I'm already thinking this has got to be a pile
Absolutely.
Of crap.
You remember the Bob Spitz?
Door stopper.
Yes. Yeah, as we referred to on the show. I remember thumbing through that in a bookstore and seeing the picture of the three Beatles in Central Park in 1964 and the little girl on John's shoulders that they identify as Julian in the book. Nice. It makes everything suspect, no matter how well
Absolutely.
It's written after
He's
that.
Undone right there.
Exactly.
It's like someone appearing before a judge in court and being caught in a lie, and
yeah.
then everything is perceived
yeah,
as a lie.
Yeah, saying their name wrong or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did check out the captions straight away when I got the
yeah,
book.
That's what
and,
I always do.
Yeah, yeah and they seemed pretty accurate to me.
Okay.
If
okay.
maybe not as descriptive as I would have been, but
right.
whatever.
Right.
But the things that are glaringly wrong are, I mean, they jump out at you and like, what the hell?
Yeah.
You know, the whole post-Beatles era of the book I thought was pretty well done in terms of, you know, putting together the story of those projects he did that were not his standard rock album stuff.
Right.
You know, the Liverpool Oratorio, he's got a great detailed telling of that whole process.
Wings Wildlife.
Well, it's funny you mention that because he actually, the least likely of journalists and writers to, you know, praise what is pretty universally panned among Paul's catalog, the Wildlife album, he actually singles out for special praise. Can you guess what?
Mumbo?
Nope, not Bebop either.
Dear friend. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. He singles that out. You know, I know that everybody has seen that because it came out after Imagine
yeah.
as a response to How Do You Sleep?
Right.
And it certainly kind of reads that way if that's what you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
The problem is it was recorded during the Ram sessions.
Yes.
So
yes, I know.
He's anticipating. He knows that John is surely going to write a very highly insulting song about me after he hears Ram.
Mm-hmm.
So let me cut him off at the pass.
And Philip Norman is now in the mode of really trying to redress the balance that he, or the imbalance that he created.
Oh, yes.
Between McCartney. So now he's the Paul defender and finding more faults with John.
Yeah, perhaps. Mm. Let's see what he has to say about this specific song.
He wanted to repeat the success of the Beatles in artistic terms, of course. It's not the same. But among all the product, the Wings product that he released, he didn't just stop being a great songwriter. There are wonderful songs buried among a lot of, you know, highly commercial hit tracks, which maybe won't have the longevity of Beatles music.
Right.
But I'm sure you know the song Dear Friend,
yes.
which is a wonderful tribute to John in so few words, wonderfully succinct, which John clearly was unaware of. If John had known about it, I don't think we would have had How Do You Sleep.
What a pile of tosh.
Peter?
I mean, really, we wouldn't have had How Do You Sleep? He knows that, even though it was recorded during the Ram sessions, as he obviously doesn't know.
Yeah. And John, in the midst of recording the Imagine album,
yeah.
would catch wind of this unreleased track.
Yeah, that's right. And
that would stop him cold.
Yeah, because he would have heard Dear Friend and been just so heartwarmed by it that he'd have just felt really bad and retracted everything he was going to say about Paul.
Spurned lover.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quite sensitive.
Yeah. Spurned lover. There okay. you go.
Now, I'm not here to bury Philip Norman, but he makes it so damn easy.
I know. I mean, it's his defense of, you know, what he's saying makes no sense. I mean, it's just like, you know, when I said earlier that he's omitted some fundamental parts of the story that, you know, were in Mark Lewisohn's Tune In book. And I think something that people have to understand is when you look at a book and you're rating a book, you're not just rating it based on what is in the book and in terms of, you know, the errors. You're also rating it often on what's not there, what's been omitted. You know, that can be every bit as important and detrimental to the final product.
In terms of, you mean information that we have that's readily available.
Absolutely.
That is, by sin of omission, not yeah. presented as if it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And well, when the whole rest of the world now knows better. I mean, it's almost as if this book could have been researched, you know, at the time of Shout.
Look, as a writer myself, something I always tell people when I'm going to co-author a book with them, a very important part of the process are the questions I ask. It's the interviewing process, because if I don't ask the right questions, you're not going to end up with the right product. So when I read, for instance, the Patty Boyd book, you know, the autobiography that she was co-written with Penny Juner.
Yeah.
And I'm reading this book with this dynamite, you know, story, you know, she's married to George Harrison and Eric Clapton. And I was so frustrated because there was so much more that I know her co-author could have asked her to delve deeper.
Yes, and that's what you're, when you're reading the book, you're, well, yeah. why don't they go here?
Right.
It's sort of obvious in your head.
Exactly.
And they just keep going.
Exactly. Yeah. So there, a big problem is not just, you know, factual, you know, correctness. It's also about what isn't in the book.
and how curious the author is in getting to where the trail is going to lead.
Right.
It's very frustrating when the line of questioning apparently cuts off just when it starts to get interesting.
Exactly. So with Philip Norman, you know, these omissions, I mean, that's not a small thing. That's a major problem with the book.
Yeah. Again, I thought the post-Beatle stuff where he's analyzing some of the other projects was pretty interesting because it made it all make sense to me.
Mm.
You know, I'd said Liverpool Oratorio. There was also Standing Stone.
Yeah.
Some of the Fireman stuff a little bit.
Right.
I mean, clearly, if you want to fault the book for one thing generally, and I think it's maybe not that fair because he didn't set out to write this as a musical, you know, revolution ahead type of book.
Mm-hmm.
He's not getting into the analysis of the music track by track or the recording, anything like that. It's a life study, okay?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to give him too much, you know, stick for that just because I don't think that was his intent.
Yeah, but you know where problems really arise is when you get to a fundamental part of the story, of the Beatles story, about how the Beatles got signed to EMI.
Yeah.
And I'm reading and I'm thinking, but hold on, he's left out what's in Mark Lewisohn's book. Which,
what we now know to be true.
What we now know to be true. And he would have known to be true while writing this book. He certainly had the time to have that information and get that in place before the book was published. And it's like, hold on, he's completely ignored it.
It's like he has his hands over his ears going la, 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 la,
yeah,
la, la.
Yeah.
And he definitely has a position on the whole Mark Lewisohn Beatle historian.
Yeah, because from his perspective, it's that, you know, he, as he puts it, discovered Mark Lewisohn.
Well, let's let him say that in his own words when we get to that.
But the point is, what I will say as a setup, is that he feels that, you know, because Mark in Tune In absolutely corrects a lot of the wrongs in Shout.
Oh, yes.
And he calls him on it. And of course, Philip, instead of basically saying mea culpa, it's like, no, he just, the best form of defense is attack.
Right.
And decides that he's just going to blank Lewisohn.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's striking to me when you know, we're experiencing this in real time, thinking the way he saw Mark as sort of the junior partner, as it were, because, you know, he was one of the researchers on Shout, Mark was.
Yeah.
And he then went on to have this flourishing career.
Yeah.
I was struck by the similarity to the way John might have looked at George.
Right.
That bloody kid.
Yeah.
And going to be dismissive of him till the day you die.
Right, right, right.
Because you cannot stand the thought that the pupil has now become, you know, your master.
Is it true that Philip Norman's actually releasing his own record? It's a remake of Frankie Lane's Jealousy.
Jealousy, night and day you torture me. I sometimes wonder if this spell that I'm under can only be a melody for I know.
This whole project may come off in some ways, because you are really sort of offering a corrective to your past publicly pronounced perceptions of Paul. Do you see it as sort of a mea culpa, like a very ambitious, I misjudge this man, and this is why, you know, you need to really look at his life with, you know, more positively than certainly I have?
When you look at a life in the detail that you have to do for that sort of biography, then you see, you know, all the nuances. And Shout was like a sketch of four people. Then I did the full-length portrait of John in Oils. And when I came to do the same with Paul McCartney, then, of course, I saw so much more. I mean, I'd always thought Mull of Kintyre was a pretty dire record. And, but then when I realized that he had released it in the middle of punk rock and the huge success, the sort of silent majority of popular music went for it in such numbers, that was an extraordinary thing to do.
So Shout, which, you know, now he basically sees the error of his ways with some of the things there.
It was a sketch.
It was just a sketch. Well, it was a long time ago, wasn't it? No
yes.
one really cares. I suppose if I was writing an open letter to Philip Norman in the Daily Mail where he refers to his full-length portrait of John Lennon in oil, it was more like an oily portrait. I mean, this revisionism is ridiculous.
It's hindsight. It's wisdom of old age.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. He's seeing things with great clarity. It's a moment of clarity, Richard.
Mm, yes, isn't it just?
That
it's a moment of clarity for all of us.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he's putting out there the fact that just as he misjudged Paul, so too does the rest of the world.
Yeah, of course.
Only today, critic in the New York Times is firmly sticking to the view that nothing McCartney did after the Beatles is worth any interest. So wrong. And to me, the absolute, you know, the virgin territory was the Wings era and the marriage with Linda and, of course, the terrible circumstances of her illness and her death. And all that, there's, you know, more than four, well over, you know, 45 years worth of McCartney output creativity, which is kind of just sort of rather dismissed. Oh, yes, and after the Beatles, he wasn't very good, and he was a bit, you know, lightweight.
Right.
There was so much to talk about in that era.
Because you had a bit of a reputation as a McCartney basher, you know, going back at least as far as Shout, but even further back than that.
Well, I did, and I was wrong. I was in the wrong. And as I say in this book, I was not fair to him in Shout. Mm-hmm. I tried to make some amends with the John Lennon book, on which he did help me very materially.
Yes.
And again, I have to say that it took me a long time to realize how the enormous importance of McCartney to bringing out the genius of Lennon. And that they are inseparable in their importance to the Beatles, their enormous importance.
Look, it's fine that he is doing a kind of mea culpa, but what does that say then for his journalism 30-something years ago?
He finally, you know, he's
gotten
it right.
Got it wrong.
Right, and now he's gotten it right.
Yeah, exactly. So we're supposed to now trust that.
Well, yeah. The world has changed since Shout, Richard.
Yeah, it has, hasn't it?
Yeah, a Beatle researcher has now reached a whole new level.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially with us.
Yes, especially with us.
Yeah.
Let the bells fly. But no, it is inescapable. It is like this gravitational force that if you are a Beatle researcher, you are always going to be pulled in by the force that is Mark Lewisohn,
mm-hmm.
because that is the gold standard. And you cannot call yourself a serious Beatle researcher of any kind if you aren't familiar with his works.
Right.
Because he's done the work.
Yeah.
And therefore, it begs the question, Philip Norman, have you heard of Mark Lewisohn? Were you at all interested in the new research that's been published in recent years?
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that was, you know, the loaded question that we had ready for him.
Yes, exactly. Having
looked at the book and seen these glaring omissions.
It was the question we wanted to ask at the onset, but we didn't want the interview to end after 30 seconds.
Correct.
So we waited him out.
Now, in the researching this book, did you read any of the other more recent works? Specifically, I'm thinking of Mark Lewisohn's work that have gotten really into depth in some of this minutiae. And if you have, has it revised any of your opinions of anything that's been presented as Beatle history to this point?
Well, I discovered Mark Lewisohn when he was a clerk at the BBC and known as the Beatle Brain of Britain. So I discovered him, and so I created a monster, I think. although he's not so infallible as he always likes to say he is. So again, I think that, and this is what American writers do so much, is to just overburden the writing with facts, just to show how many facts you know. And that is not what I think good writing should be. Good writing is the use of fewer facts strategically to illustrate a point.
Stunning. I mean, really, I know, you know, a lot of people may know that I'm, you know, a really good friend of Mark Lewisohn, but I hope they realize that anyone objectively would say that what he's just said there is a real pile of piffle. I mean, really, that journalism.
What is it, Tosh?
I mean, he starts off with the bitchery that, you know, he was just a clerk at the BBC, which he wasn't, you know, and
he was an accountant, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was in the accounts office, and you know, and the whole thing about, you know, that I created a monster. He created, of course.
He's taking responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort
you have
of
to
half,
admire that.
Half expecting to hear a scene from Frankenstein. You know, he's alive, he's alive.
Right.
But then...
Young Frankenstein would be more suitable.
Yeah, but then when we get beyond that, you know, this whole thing about, you know, Philip Norman telling us what good journalism is.
Yeah.
I mean, he takes a swipe at the Americans. I love the way that he can just generalize about American authors.
We like facts, unlike you Brits.
Yeah, right. There you go. But the fact that, you know, too many facts get in the way of good writing. I mean, where do you go with that? He's just nailed himself to the cross.
He's got to slip some fiction in there.
I mean, really stunning. And the other thing is, we've seen those Beatle books, which are just completely, like, literally lists of facts. Mm. There's no way that that's what Tune In is. You know, is that all he's seeing there? That there are just nonstop facts. There's no real writing around.
You're assuming he's seen it.
Well,
he just admitted as much.
I mean, that
it's not
is
on his radar.
That is like the worst defense of his position that he could have really come up with, because his definition of what good authorship and journalism is just, all I can say is stunning.
This is the key to understanding the book, Richard. If you're not into facts, okay, this immediately dismisses away all the factual errors that we found in the book.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, okay, but it's in the name of a good narrative.
Oh, there you go.
So now, you understand that, you understand everything.
Yes.
There it is.
Yeah, don't get wound up by the facts. Just enjoy a good poetic
right.
read.
Right. 800 pages.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right.
Right.
You know, pay your $25 to get the biography on McCartney, but please ignore facts.
You don't use them randomly.
No.
You have to use them sparingly.
Yeah, sparingly, and position them in the right way to make for good writing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And actually put in some incorrect facts as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Which otherwise known as fiction.
Yeah.
Lies, untruths.
Yeah.
He didn't mention that, but I mean, that's the implication. If you use the facts sparingly, then you liberal use of untruths explains it all.
I mean, I really don't know how anyone could defend that position that he takes.
He's worked it out.
Yeah, what, with a pencil?
Years. This is the zenith of the arc of his career. Mm. This is the epiphany he's reached after 40
odd years. So basically, Shout was just a sketch.
Yes.
Okay. We shouldn't take much notice of that now. He messed that all up. And now we're getting to hear really what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
It's about forget the facts, just a few good ones here and there, but really just focus on the flowery writing.
Well, I thought at this juncture it was worth finding out where he wants to apply his oils next.
Now, I have to ask the question, now that you've done a Beatles book and a John book and a Paul book, do you see yourself doing a George book in the future?
I don't. No, I don't. I just don't think that there is the same substance. George did write some very good songs, but he didn't write that many. And I think it was because John and Paul's magic rubbed off on George eventually. And there is something about him that is kind of a bit grim and humorless. And I just don't think I could go through what you have to go through to write one of these books. I don't think I could do that for a George Harrison biography.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it what makes it so compelling is the fact that by all accounts, he had such a wonderfully supportive childhood. I mean, the Harrison family was great in terms of encouraging him and being there for him well into the Beatle years and being welcoming to the fans, very happy. But the bitterness manifests itself pretty early on. And for a guy who was, you know, for most of his life chasing this peace of mind and seeing beyond earthly plane of existence, he could be incredibly petty and mean-spirited. You know, there was like a very strong division in the two sides of him that everybody who revered him spoke of. And I don't think that was explored into any great depth at all in the Martin Scorsese documentary. So
that's hagiography.
Yeah. Yeah. It just seems ripe for exploration by somebody.
I think so, but then what are you going to explore? I mean, I don't think there's no point in writing a book that, you know, that denigrates the subject and decides the subject is unpleasant, like the late Albert Goldman used to do.
Yeah.
You have to love your subject. If your subject, even if your subject is a monster, and neither John or Paul was a monster, you have to love your monster. And, I just cannot see basing a major biography on George, important though he was, and huge though his fan base still is, undoubtedly.
Right. Well, I won't even ask about Ringo then.
Well, at least George and Ringo will be spared.
Yes. Maybe we should try that as our approach going forward, to more discriminate use of facts in our shows, so not to get in the way of the narrative.
That's right, because, you know, just our style should be able to carry the shows, you see.
Instead of just trying to show off everything we know.
Exactly. Discuss and squabble about whatever, but forget, you know, don't laden it too much with facts.
No.
Although you as an American might want to do that.
That
because,
is true.
Because you tend towards that, don't you, as an American?
For the benefit of our American listeners,
I
at least will keep issuing the facts.
Yeah, you'll just list loads and loads and loads of facts.
Yes.
And I'll just be all style and no substance. How
there
about
you go.
That? There you go.
In other words, just carry on.
My name is Robert Rodriguez.
Something about
the Beatles.
Something About the Beatles, recorded at Strand Studios, produced by Thomas Repetney. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song recorded by the Corgis.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
When you love riding a motorcycle, you want to ride it everywhere, even to a physical.
Let's check your weight. Hop on the scale. Look at that. You're down a few pounds.
Oh, yeah. Must be the new carbon fiber wheels.
And when you love saving money, you want to save even more. That's why GEICO makes it easy to bundle your motorcycle and car insurance.
I'm going to prescribe 91 octane for your engine knock, and we'll want to see you again in 3,000 miles.
Kickstart your savings with GEICO Motorcycle. Bundle and save on the things you love.